The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
They have no economic issues except we'll give everything for free to everybody. And that's where they're all running hard to the left. And then we're going to take wealth from all you people, which I find hilarious that they're talking to going after all these tech billionaires who are overwhelmingly leftists. But they just thought, yeah, we'll keep talking left. We'll support all these leftist candidates. And if you look at history, that's what happens all the time. When the powers that be get scared of the left, they support them, they give them money, and then they come and they get them. And then they chop their heads off with the guillotine.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney, and we have one of my favorite guests on today, Bill King.
You know, when we think of investing, we think of it as one of the last expressions of the liberal arts where you're synthesizing information from so many different fields. And I think Bill King brings that together in a very real way, whether it's politics, geopolitics, finance, economics, reading charts. Just an amazing job, a masterful job of bringing that synthesis together. And so, as always, we're excited to kind of get the feedback as we look at sort of issues within the political arena. But of course, our focus ultimately being on the financial markets and what the implications are from public policy, from international relations, into the pricing of the markets, the risk there, and the opportunities as well.
David, of everything that we read on a daily basis, Bill King is something none of us miss. You know, he sends a message out 1 o'clock in the morning, 1:30 in the morning, and it gives us an idea of what he's looking for the next day. One of the things that he's really brought up this time around, because we've read Bill King for decades, is that the Federal Reserve and central banking in general is doing things very, very different at this point. They used to look at inventory. They used to look at inflation, the debt cycle, and allow for growth and shrinkage in the economy. At this time, that's not the case. And it reminds me when I was a lawn and garden manager at a lumber store when I was in my late teens, I took a clinic on fertilizers. And when we put these fertilizers on our grass that kill dandelions, the reason it kills the dandelions is the broadleaf plants is because it only allows growth and it accelerates the growth of the plant. What happens is the plant just grows very, very quickly and then dies. It seems like that same policy is now going on with our economy. The central banks only want growth, no shrinkage.
Well, that is a very significant shift because they used to be willing to precipitate and participate in causing a down cycle within the business community so that you wouldn't end up with too much inflation, so that you wouldn't end up with excess inventory, so that you could control the debt cycle and that pile of dollars owed. And now, being afraid of the quantities of debt, they've changed their tune, and it really is like feeding the dandelions. Now, of course, all they see is the growth aspect. What you're suggesting is that there may be an unintended consequence to promoting that fertilizer mentality.
Yeah, you know, late in quarter four of 2018, we thought possibly there would be a tightening. We started to see the markets coming off, but Powell folded right away. He wanted to go ahead and kill those dandelions by continuing to grow.
So, Bill, welcome back to the show. I am curious, just starting off our conversation today, how significant was the Powell shift late Q4, early Q1 of 2019, and some of the implications?
Well, I think it is significant. I think, you know, as I've written here before, is it's very significant from the standpoint of the U.S. because everybody's focused on the Fed and also, you know, a lot of other people around the world. But what had been happening even before Powell's shift was that China has started really pumping up credit. They started throwing a lot of reserve in the system. They started, you know, fueling their markets. And as most people realize, you know, they were concerned about their credit bubble. They were concerned about their stock bubble. So they started reining in credit in their stock market. And then, you know, before Powell made his U-turn, China was flooding the system with money. Now, the smarter people that watched that and watched China saw what was going on. And that's, you know, a lot of reasons why gold took off. You know, as anybody that watches gold and metals know, the Chinese are the ones that really call the tune. They're the ones, you know, the iron ore, the copper, that stuff. Everybody's watching China to see what they're doing. And when that credit that started pouring back in, those markets took off. Now, we kept falling. A lot of it was because of momentum here. A lot of it was tax at the end of the year. There's a lot of things going on that pushed everything down into Christmas Eve. And then, you know, you got the Powell U-turn. One of the things, too, that caught people was I thought he was going to be more dovish on the Fed meeting there in the third week of December. And so did most people. When he wasn't, you know, the stocks got hammered. I mean, you had a triple, which some people call it quadruple, but I don't think the futures on individual stocks are significant. But that was what kind of got people really turned around. You had the Fed meeting was December 19th. You had the expiration on 21st. Everybody thought, we've seen this story before, that the stocks are weak because they're worried about the Fed. The Fed has their meeting, and then all of a sudden you start to stay on a rally. Plus, you got the expiration futures and options on Friday. I actually had set up a little bit with some calls because I thought that was going to happen. Instead, he didn't. He was kind of more negative, more hawkish than people thought. And if you remember, stocks got hit. And of course, what happens then on the 21st being Friday, when you have a bad expiration, the traders are caught the wrong way. Fortunately, I just had some cheap calls on that didn't, you know, I had nothing to worry about on Monday, but people that had stocks, whatever, and with Christmas coming up, and as you know, a lot of people go on vacation for Christmas week, that's why that Christmas Eve got absolutely pounded. That was a lot of the traders caught the wrong way for expiration. As you know, traders play for up expirations. They thought this was going to be huge. It didn't happen. So then Powell makes the U-turn afterwards. But more importantly, the stocks had started up because of China. You know, I think my analogy was China was just fueling, spreading fuel everywhere. And then Powell came in and threw the match here. For the people that don't pay as much attention as the real pros do, you know, the pros that are watching the credit, they're watching these other things. Not the people that just turn on, you know, the financial media and want somebody to tell them what to do. You know, that's what Powell did. But Powell told those people to jump in. But the smart people, these two people, were already positioning themselves for what China was doing. Now, we had that little wrinkle. We had the down week last week because the Chinese credit growth unexpectedly collapsed in February. That's why you had 5 days down in a row for the S&P and 11 down days for the Dow Transportations. This week is strictly expiration, the games that they're playing here. You saw the big Monday rally. You know, they always have that one day early in the week. You have that big triple-digit gain somewhere between Monday and Wednesday for the expiration. Then you kind of hang around. Then either Thursday or Friday, you have the rally. Now, today, we're getting a big rally on Friday. Part of it is because the option futures expiration. But the other part was China announced last night some more stimulus. And they also put out, oh, we're making great progress on this U.S.-China trade deal talk. But then when you read the Chinese premier statements, oh, yeah, when they asked him about industrial espionage, oh, that's against Chinese law. We would never do it. Well, then you know that everything was, you know, he's just lying. The whole routine there, as soon as that happened, you know, everybody knows what China's been doing for 20 years here as far as industrial espionage. And that's one of the factors that's holding up the trade negotiations, you know, the intellectual property enforcement and this espionage that's been going on here. So, yeah, Powell was significant, but actually the Chinese making the U-turn on their credit was even bigger.
So the closer we get to the trade negotiations, it feels like we lose the forest for the trees. This year, we mark the 70th anniversary of the founding of the Communist Party. We've got the 60th anniversary of the Dalai Lama fleeing to Tibet, the 30th anniversary of Tiananmen and the massacre there in Tiananmen Square. And yeah, we're locked in negotiations on a trade deal with China. Maybe take us up a little bit. Take us to 30,000 feet. What's really unfolding? We've got geostrategic issues, long-term economic perspective. You know, again, help us regain the forest.
Well, that's what we don't know. We see ostensibly what they put out in the media, that this is trade. Now, we know it's tied a bit to North Korea. There's other issues in the, you know, in the South China Sea with defense issues and the U.S. sending planes into disputed area, two bombers early this week. There's geopolitical issues that we're not privy to. There's no question. You're right. So Trump and his people, and pretty clear, is he wants a trade deal here for economic reasons, but also he thinks it's going to shoot the stock market 2,000 points higher. I'm assuming he's talking industrial average, Dow Industrial, and that's going to help the economy, blah, 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 blah. Well, I don't think he's going to get that kind of gain. As you know, I've been talking that when you get a trade deal, you're going to get a top. Just like when you got the tax deal. I mean, God, we rallied for a year on the hype of Trump's tax deal. It showed up in January. We peaked in February. Then we had the VIX fix crash in February. I would suspect that that would be similar stock market action once you do get a China trade deal. Because let's face it, you're not going to change that trade deficit that much. You might get it marginally. It's going to be more political. You're talking a real, to change that, you know, whatever it is, $400 billion, $500 billion trade deficit. It's just not good because, oh, we're going to buy more soybeans. You know, who cares? The Chinese have to buy food product. Every time you say, well, we're buying more soybeans, who cares? That's not a big deal. It's like, well, we're not buying soybeans. Oh, and then, Trump's going to get hurt with the farmers in Iowa. They have, and you saw they always come back. They have to feed their population. If they don't buy U.S. soybeans, they're just going to go somewhere else. you know, they have to buy somewhere else, and the price is going to go up, and the U.S. will send their soybeans to, you know, Indonesia or wherever they have to send them. But, you know, that's garbage. The bigger thing to me, because you're talking intellectual property and some of this other stuff, is their behavior. Stop the espionage. Stop the stealing. Stop counterfeiting U.S. goods, which they've been doing for what, however many decades. You know, and that's what they're all coming back to. How do you enforce it? How do you enforce it? Right. How do you stop this behavior? And you're right. Your question is absolutely provocative and right. Is how much this is just a big kabuki theater for China and the U.S. on the world stage? And, you know, for Trump for re-election and for the Chinese, China to tell everybody else who's getting alarmed by their practices, not just the U.S., that, yeah, we're going to be good citizens. You know, you let us in the WTO. You know, you gave us all this stuff. You know, thank you, Bush and Clinton people, for allowing us to print all these trillions of dollars from your guys' economy. And we're going to be good citizens now. Don't, you know, don't look at the past behavior. We're going to be good now. I don't know. You know, you don't know. You can't project. You got to see how it plays out. I do think China realizes that, you know, as bad as we talk about debt here in the United States, their debt situation is far worse. And that's what we know. And we don't know what these provinces that, you know, tend to write like independent little sovereigns all over China, because, you know, you're talking to, you know, 1.3 billion people. You know, there's a lot of provinces that run pretty independently and, you know, area warlords and everything else. There's no way of getting a good grip on their debt problem. And the other thing is Trump is campaigning and his practice, he's copying other people, you know, and he's kind of been clear, whether it's Andrew Jackson, you know, with his populism and hard nose and rhetoric and acerbicness, and Reagan with some of the stuff he didn't even Nixon. So you wonder how much of this is Trump trying to copy what Reagan did to the Soviet Union, you know, fighting an economic war and bringing them in to do, you know, the Reykjavik with the peace routine. And then eventually, you know, you hope you get, you know, like you had the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, I don't know how much Trump is looking at the economic war aspects of this, knowing that now's the time to get China because of their debt situation and, you know, their vulnerabilities. You know, that's your question, Dave. And, you know, we don't know. You know, we all suspect there is more to it than this, and there almost certainly is, but we just don't know yet, and, you know, we won't know for some time.
Well, I've got a book on my shelf from a Harvard guy who's made the case last year that war with China is inevitable.
You know, as soon as you say a guy from Harvard talking international, I guess, you know, then we know that's usually garbage, right? When have they been writing? You know, haven't the Ivy League academics done enough damage to this country in foreign policy and economics, you know, in over the last... You know, when have they been right? But, you know, yeah, they said that. Then weren't those guys telling us that for 50 years of the Soviet Union? So we fought a Cold War, we fought whatever. You know, we're constantly a Cold War with somebody, right? I mean, it's right. Just the way it is. And then, of course, with the hackers, the cyber, whatever, it's... You know, before we used to run the submarine games out there and send the bombers in and the fighter jets, whatever, and probe and do espionage and, you know, James Bond stuff. You know, now you do it online.
Right.
So nothing's inevitable. If you make policy miscalculations, then you get a hot war.
You know, coming back around to the trade thing and how that relates to the markets, in recent comments, you mentioned the empire state building chart formation.
Right.
Where if you get a trade deal, there's a lot of enthusiasm, market goes higher, but that's it. And maybe that is a top that is significant. Well, how significant do you think that kind of a top would be?
You'll get some kind of top. We also don't know what China and the Fed are going to do, you know, the other policies after. But I would say the minimum, you're going to get a trading top on something like that. And if it gets real wild, you could be an intermediate. Now, if you do that and you also have the economy keeps degrading like it is, then you're talking a very significant top, maybe the top type of thing. And that's when you have any kind of tops. It's hard to put a label like, oh, this is the top. It is a top, some type of top. And that's what I think you'll get. Just like it was pretty clear you were going to get some kind of top on the tax thing. Well, that didn't turn out to be the ultimate top, but it was a very significant top. And then you had that horrible VIX crash afterward. I would suspect, again, that some kind of China trade deal is going to be somewhat like that top we had, you know, early in 2018, and then you're going to have some real difficulty. The problem we have now is just like that VIX crash. There's so many traders and fast money in the market that it's dwarfing the investment-grade money. And you can't say it's different this time. Well, it is different this time because in the past, the trading money were parasites. They just ran around the elephants, tried to pick off, you know, some gains here and there. That's not the case anymore. Now you have trillions of dollars on leverage running into the markets daily, causing this manic behavior. In the past, you know, it was the big elephants, the institutions, created the trends in the market, and they lasted for a while. I mean, a hedge fund, a $100 million hedge fund used to be significant. Now it's a joke. And that's the problem. Furthermore, you've got so much passive investing. You've got the ETF investing. You know, you've got consolidation of money managers where a handful of guys are hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars they manage. So on a daily basis now, except for the last hour of the day when you got some ETF things going on there at JP Morgan or State Street or wherever else you have to do things to square up there, you don't have the investment grade money in the market creating stability up or down. But when they tend to move, which that's why the fourth quarter was so devastating, is the traders kept trying to run things. You could see at night, they kept manipulating the S&Ps higher, trying to create rallies, which is the fast money because, you know, they were getting their brains beat in for the end of the year. But the investment grade money, the real money, the organic money just kept selling because they saw the economy was weakening in there, which is what Powell saw, which is what China saw. And that's what's so difficult now is knowing where the big institutions are, when they're going to start moving in mass. And that's what caught everybody by surprise in the fourth quarter. And if you get a situation with China trade deal, you blow up whatever, and at the same time, the U.S. economy is rolling over and rolling into recession, that's a tough mix. You know, I've written up before, and I'm actually going to repeat again here for Monday, is the most dangerous environment for the equity market is when you got stocks blowing up to the upside because the economy is weakening, and you got the idiot money doing this because they think, oh, this is good, the Fed has to ease, or they have to commence an easing cycle. Well, the problem is you look historically, it takes at least for an average around 6 months before stocks start turning up after the Fed has commenced an easing cycle. We know they haven't started an easing cycle yet. So you're a long way from when stocks normally react to the upside on an easing cycle. And the other thing is Powell, a lot of people thought, listening to Powell, because the economy was weakening at the end of last year, when he was talking so hawkish, and you could see it dribble out. He didn't want to come right out and say it. Trump said it. But they were concerned about the stock market. You could see that there was even some of the guys that had been former dubs were talking about, they're concerned about the stock market. And that's why a lot of people thought that they were talking hawkish and that you were going to get these hikes. You know, they had the four penciled in here, two for 2018 and two for 2019. And why they went away from these, they thought that the stocks were getting out of control. So you got a Fed meeting this week. People are looking for them to be dovish again because of the economy. I mean, the evidence is clear the economy is softening. The problem Powell has and the Fed is they can't come out and be as dovish on the economy as they want to be because stocks are blowing up again. And again, this is the most dangerous environment situation you have is stocks blowing up to the upside on perception of Fed easing when the economy is rolling over. I mean, that's what 2007 was. In 2008, the Dow Jones Transportation is an all-time high in July with oil. But you're already at least two quarters into recession. That's not supposed to happen. The stocks are supposed to top out 6 months ahead of time, but we've changed. You know, we've changed how the relationship between stocks and the economy and how the people perceive the Fed. And again, this is because of the wacky money, the fast money, the trading money, the hyper money. And, you know, and as you know, they can get real crazy and they can get crazy for a long time until the real, the organic people show up and then, you know, then they get punished. But, you know, there's no telling when that's going to start happening.
Yeah, a few weeks ago, the Bank of International Settlements noted this extraordinarily tight relationship between policymakers and the financial markets. Claudio Borio, you know, Bloomberg was talking about this, you know, saying the linkages in part explain the Federal Reserve's decision to put interest rate hikes on hold. You know, the question that is kind of in the back of my mind, is this a permanent state of affairs where you've got central banks and the financial markets kind of locked in an intimate two-step? Are they inseparable where, again, it's just accommodation after accommodation after accommodation, higher prices after higher prices after higher prices? It seems a little crazy, but maybe that's the new normal.
It is the new normal for now, and it's the equivalent to societal where the stock market used to be a barometer of the economy. And then people started, because of Greenspan and others, they started saying, well, no, the stock market is an instrument, you know, the wealth effect. You know, that anybody who studied economics decades ago, you know, when you had that plus Z, you know, remember in that formula, oh, the wealth effect. You know, we have taxes, we have monetary policy, and then we have the wealth effect. And that used to be kind of minor. Now everybody's wealth effect thing is blowing up. And that's what they can't get a grip on. Now, I think it's beyond just the wealth effect because we know it really tends to be a high-end effect. You know, Tiffany's does well, and Sotheby's, and, you know, some of the consumer discretionary type of things. And, you know, and that's what we've known over the last 10 years, that you've created, because of this, you've created this historic discrepancy in wealth and income. And that's fueling this move to socialism. And that's the other thing that's scaring the Fed in here, too, is, yeah, we do more QE, we blow the stock market up higher, we're going to just keep exacerbating the gap between the haves and the have-nots, and we're going to get more socialism, more political turmoil. You know, we got Trump this time. God knows what we get next time if we keep doing this. But that's only part of their equation. Because I am convinced the other part of the equation is the debt. Anybody with half a brain understands the debt. Normally, when you have down cycles, recessions, historically, the Fed created recessions because they saw usually three problems. It didn't have to be all three, but it had to be at least one and usually two. And if the Fed saw inflation really picking up, they would try to stop that. Or if they saw inventories, people forget that years ago when you saw huge inventory builds, the Fed would be concerned and they would start breaking the economy, you know, in doing that. And then when they saw debt piling up, and usually the debt in the inventory kind of went hand in hand, that they were seeing the economy, these people were getting a little too speculative, not on the stock market, but on the economy, the business, the captains of industry, and they would, let's slow it down. And what you would do is you would force inventory liquidation and you would also force debt liquidation, and people would go bankrupt, and you know, the banks would have to write off debt, and then you had a nice, fresh, healthy cycle. But it is apparent to anybody paying attention that the central banks around the world are petrified of any downturn. Again, this was a natural cycle. This was like, you know what, we can never have autumn or winter. We can only have spring and summer. We had to just keep letting this stuff grow to the moon. And the only explanation for that is the debt. They are petrified of a debt deflation cycle. And of course, because of what happened in 2008, when for a while there, it was over. The system, they didn't know what they were going to do. They didn't know if the big banks, the brokerage firms, they didn't know how this thing was going to go. And that is the explanation. Of course, that, if you really want to think about it, that puts you in a terrible, terrible situation where, oh my God, you can never take a downturn, which we know is impossible. You know, that you just can't do this. Or you're going to run this thing so hot, you blow this thing up, and then you had this unbelievable crash, which is, you know, that's essentially what happened with 08, because they wouldn't stop it. You know, everybody was afraid of, even back then, they didn't want this thing to stop because of the debt. And so they just did kind of let it finally blow up here. So the bigger picture looking forward here is, anybody paying attention argued that with all the QE and the zero interest rate and the negative interest rates, you're not forcing the usual debt destruction, reining the debt in, wiping out bad debts, writing away malinvestment, you know, taking the weak sisters out of the economy. You didn't. You know, you kept zombie corporations, zombie banks, and they just kept this whole game going. And that, to me, is the biggest concern when you look out there, is why are they afraid of a recession? Any recession. And that shouldn't be the case. In fact, it's totally unnatural.
Well, you look overseas, and you were talking about, you know, the stock market blowing up to higher levels with the economy softening. We've got shrinkage in South Korea and Taiwanese manufacturing to 3.5-4-year lows. You know, so you've got some signs that global trade and global GDP are on a downward trajectory.
Yep.
Can the U.S. maintain GDP growth if the rest of the world is floundering? And doesn't that really argue for us having a recession sooner than later, in which case this is where all of a sudden, you know, it's like a 25-car pileup.
You're hitting on something that's very interesting with the globalization, because you go back before the 80s, and that is, you would have economies where they talk about being harmonized. Obviously, the U.S. was the elephant in the room. And if the U.S. went down, everybody went down. It was very hard for other countries, and that's still the case. China helped Germany greatly. People forget how bad Germany was around 2005 and 6, and because of China's industrialization, buying all those machine tools and, you know, industrial, they saved Germany in here. But, you know, these idiots from the Ivy League ran around in the late 80s and 90s going, oh, globalization, we want to, and the central banks, we're going to harmonize their economies. That's ridiculous. That's like having a baseball team say, oh, we want everybody to hit their peak right now. What you forget is that when you go in a slump, there's nobody there to pick up the team. So you win a bunch of games 15-0, and then all of a sudden you get your brains beat in when everybody goes in the toilet. You know, that you don't want your baseball, everybody hitting at their peak at the same time. I know it's kind of a bad analogy, but that's the point here, is if you've harmonized everybody's economy, that's why you get something like 2008, because there's nobody there to soften the blows of other countries. And you know, that was the big hope with China, that China will get this 1.3 billion people consuming, and then everybody can dump stuff into China. And that's not happening. And the Chinese are preventing it for a number of reasons. You know, that, again, is part of this trade negotiation, whatever, in here. But, yeah, this whole let's harmonize our central bank policy. I mean, it used to be if one central bank was easing, another was tightening, whatever. You saw in the currency market, people say, oh, we're going to buy that currency. You know, the Deutsche Bank is running a sound policy, as is the Swiss National Bank, and the Bank of England's pumping. And then it would change, you know, the Bank of England. So you had that going on. And now that correlated loosely with the economies of where people were. But now you got everybody pumping like crazy. You know, you can find somebody who's running. You know, that was why the dollar got strong, because the talk here last year was Powell, well, the U.S. is trying to normalize rates. Nobody else will do it. Nobody else is going to normalize policy or rates. The U.S. is going to do it. And that's still, you know, even with Powell's U-turn, we haven't started easing. So that's another reason why the dollar's been hanging in here. But you're right. Your questioning is absolutely presenting the problems out there with the modern coordination of central banks and economies. That's a problem when they start all slipping together.
Well, so now you've got, you know, China in a very different place than they were a few years ago. At the same time, if you look at the ECB communiques, you've got the language back as long as necessary is the language they're using. They've already introduced a third round of long-term refinancing operations. That's for September. You know, is this to buy time? Is there a point where market participants see the lack of robust recovery in Europe? And we've been using any and all means necessary already. When do market participants start getting defensive, saying, look, you can rehash the old game, but it's not working? And here we have China probably not in a position to bail out Germany and the Eurozone on this go-round.
Well, you're right. You know, your later point is right. You know, they've had their massive industrialization already. And you're right. Germany's not going to get that kick again. Nobody knows. Well, you know when you get to the inflection point, but you don't know what the tipping point is. And that's what, going right back to the very beginning in your first questioning with Powell's U-turn, is, you know, he understands we're at an inflection point. But what is the tipping point? And that's, as we've learned with markets, it can take a long time. I mean, anybody who was paying attention knew that the U.S. financial system went down in August 2007. Everything just fell apart. The T-bills went down to 0.14. There was collateral problems all over the globe. People were defaulting on deliveries. But you didn't have everything really hit the fan until the August, November of 2008. And where it really started was February of 2007, because we know that's when Goldman went to AIG and made them put up more collateral for their credit default swaps, because they were afraid AIG was going down. That was February. By summer, people started figuring out that you had this horrible situation developing. And then we had Bear Stearns go down, what, in March of 2008? But you can see, again, where's the tipping point? You never know. And again, there was a lot of bad things going on, but you know, you don't know when the psychology just turns and, you know, falls apart.
Now, we're back to that era where the conversation about ZIRP, zero interest rates, and negative interest rates are on the table. Draghi's claiming negative interest rates have been a success. Not exactly sure for whom. We've got Williams with the New York Fed talking about, look, during the next recession, we'd roll out QE and negative interest rates. I'm wondering, how do historians write this period of history? How do they document and talk about the financial repression, the move to ZIRP, the move to NERP, and kind of the illusion of success? I mean, Draghi claims it's just obvious. This has been a great story.
Well, if they're not careful, the powers that be aren't careful, they're going to be writing it in a similar vein of the French Revolution, because that's effectively what brought the French Revolution apart. You know, you had the Mississippi bubble, and John Law pumping the money like crazy to finance the Louis and all the wars they want to find, the palaces and all this extravagance. And then when that blew up, it blew up just ahead of the South Sea bubble that England started running, because they thought France had found, you know, at first they laughed at France. Look at these idiots are doing this. And then they started benefiting from it. They go, oh my God, we need a bubble. We got to do this.
Let's get in on this.
Yeah, let's join them and do the South Sea bubble. And then, you know, 1720, it all starts blowing up. Now, England went and punished the people that ran the bubble and did things. And they became the leading financial center of the world. France did what we're doing. They did the repression. They confiscated gold, but the aristocracy bought the gold. They put in all these laws. They raised taxes, but then they gave the lords trade benefits or other little benefits, right? I mean, very familiar. I mean, right? Very familiar what you're hearing here. And what you did is you destroyed the middle class and the merchant class. It took time, and they did it. And then eventually, when you destroy your merchant middle class, they join the ranks of the have-nots, and they're the ones that foment the revolution. That's where the revolution always comes from. It comes from the merchant class and the middle class. And that's what you're destroying. And if you do more QE, you do more NERP, how can you believe Draghi to central bankers? You know what? It's like saying, you know what? I'm going to cure you. I'm going to give you a medicine, and you're going to be cured. And 10 years later, you're still on the medicine. It goes, yeah, see, I told you it's working. Well, if it works, it cures you, and you don't need the medicine. It's really stupid when you think that you're still here 10 years in, and they still have to do these things, and they're talking about doing more. Why are they talking about doing more? So, you know, it's a confidence game. Literally and figuratively, it's a confidence game going on right now. And again, the reason these guys are trying to con everybody is because of the debt. I mean, that was the thing of the 30s, where you have these debt. That's what happened historically. I mean, that was Kondratiev, right? The Russian economist, and the communist said, here, you know, go look at capitalism, tell everybody why capitalism is doomed to failure, and that communism is what's going to dominate the world. And he looked at it and goes, you know, we see these gigantic cycles, these, whatever, 70, 75-year cycles, which just happens to correlate with biblical debt jubilees of 75 years. And what happens is the capitalism gets going and people get stupid and they get over-enthusiastic, and then you get this big wipeout. And you have these depressions and the debt and everything. But that creates a new cycle and you get better growth, which is really what happened a lot in the 19th century. We had this enormous rapid growth. And then the academics say, oh, well, we need a Fed to smooth out the cycle. And now we're running into the end game here of the central bank's intervention and control of the economy. And eventually you get Venezuela, or you get the Weimar Republic, something like that. That's where you're headed here. And that's what they're afraid of, because you're not allowing the debt jubilee. You're not allowing the debt wipeout so you can cleanse the system, whether it's the, you know, you're looking at what, $1.3 trillion, $1.2 trillion in student loan debt. You're looking at the, what was automotive debt, getting near $1 trillion. That was the problem from the 2008. You didn't allow these institutions and big banks to get, not saying they have to be wiped out, but just make them, force them to clean themselves up. And they didn't. I mean, if you would have wiped out a lot of the, nationalized some of these big banks, who would have got hurt? The guys who got hurt would be the guys that owned the bonds and this common stock, and Jamie Dimon and all these executives like him that had stock options. They were the ones that would have got hit. And what did they suffer? 1 year? Year and a half? Look at what they've made. Right. Look where their stocks have gone afterward.
It's the benefits to the new aristocracy.
Well, that's it. Again, this is French Revolution stuff going on here.
The difference between the inflection point and the tipping point, I think, is very intriguing. And I hear discussions about, you know, the potential merger between Deutsche Bank and Commerce Bank. And to me, it's this echo of 1931. You had the merger between Bodenkreditanstalt and Kreditanstalt, and then the collapse there in 31. And it's almost like, look, we don't have to deal with the issues. We'll just make a happy marriage. It'll all be happy and healthy moving forward. Bigger is better. You know, and that's unhealth in the European banking sector. Periodically, over the last quarter or so, we've had Goldman Sachs and the credit default swap prices increasing for them. Is it potentially the tipping point within the credit markets? Is it in the derivatives market? I mean, again, I'm asking a question. I don't know that you have an answer.
It usually starts in the credit, because that's the smarter market. You know, the credit market is far smarter than equity. Equities get it last. We know that. You know, whether it's 2007-08, or you know what was happening here, even the turnaround to the upside here, the credit markets get it first. And you're hitting a real important point: is the derivatives. You would have thought after 2008, that whole thing was because of derivatives, credit default swaps. That's what amplified. It wasn't real estate that caused it. Real estate was a problem, but so was real estate, though. In the late 80s, right? The Texas real estate and all that was going down. You had to have the RTC. Well, we didn't have anywhere near the impact on the economy or the financial system that you had in 2008, and that was because they allowed this derivative game to get out of control. And I would have thought for sure that the powers that be would have won into these big banks and reined them in. Well, anybody who's paying attention realized Deutsche Bank was the one that had the biggest derivative book. And now you're sitting there with this situation, and what do you do with Deutsche Bank? And you're right. They're trying to force some kind of merger. They're trying to put this stuff together. Now, to go back in time, when you get forced mergers, especially with banks, you got to be very careful. Everybody understands in the 80s, you know, Reagan ran this economic war against the Soviet Union, and he had help with the Saudis and then the Pope and whatever, and you crushed oil, and the Soviet Union was the biggest oil producer in the world at that time, and you know, big commodities and semi-precious metals and rare metals, whatever, and you destroyed their economy, and they were fighting in Afghanistan, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, you also hurt state of Texas and oil-producing nations here. So what did you do to Texas? You wiped out a lot of those banks that have been around forever, right? Bank of Southwest, Texas Commerce, whatever. What did you do? You sent in the New York money center banks to buy them out. And what we don't know is how much of this was the government saying you have to go buy these banks, and how much of it was, you know, people in these money center banks going, oh, this is great. Let's go. We can get our hands into Texas and other areas on the cheap here. Well, where's those money center banks now? Do you see Manufacturers Hanover? Do you see Chemical Bank? Do you see Bankers Trust anymore?
Yeah.
Where are they? You know, you merge Chase and J.P. Morgan. Well, you have Chase, J.P. Morgan, you have Citibank. All the other ones disappeared because that was just too much for them to take on. And that's what you're seeing here with Germany is Deutsche Bank's the elephant. Now they're trying to find somebody who's they can merge them together, try to clean up and create a clean situation. But instead of having one bad bank, you end up with two bad banks. And that's the point of when you start government starts forcing or inducing takeovers to prevent the big debt deflation in here. And that's, again, just go back and look what happened in the late 80s with the energy banks, the Texas banks going down and other areas, and when the New York money centers came in and bought them up, and what happened to them eventually.
When we talk about the dynamic of the French Revolution and sort of the revulsion, the middle class being destroyed, the merchant class being destroyed, there are these sociological aspects, cultural aspects. Mm-hmm. You know, most recently with, you know, paying $200,000-$400,000 to get your kid into an Ivy League school. You know, but that same level of corruption and the general public's revulsion with that idea, same thing happens in the derivatives market. You probably watched what happened with Hovnanian and Blackstone, kind of, almost the equivalent of insurance fraud, and yet nothing's going to happen there. You know, where you say, hey, skip this bond payment and it'll trigger a default. We'll have a huge amount of money flow our way and we'll cut you a deal on the next loan you need. I mean, like levels of corruption and self-dealing that boggle the mind. And will it be any surprise at all when revolution is there? Because people say, I'm revolted by, I cannot stand this kind of a thing. So, you know, the U.S. domestic political issues make all the sense in the world as we see, you know, Ocasio-Cortez or Maxine Waters or, you know, break up Amazon and all this stuff is, it's because what is in the atmosphere is revulsion before revolution.
Right. No, you're right. And that's why it's so important to have a robust and prosperous middle class. And that's what we had here from the 50s and the 60s, because you don't have the envy, right? Because you say, hey, you know, I provide for my family. We have a nice life. We're not living extravagant, but we've got nice things. We can, you know, take nice vacations. We have, you know, this, that, and the other. Our kids are getting nice educations. We're in a safe neighborhood, yada, yada, yada. What else do you really need in life? Yeah, so what, guys flying on jets and whatever and blah, blah. But then when you start, your living standards start going down, and then you see extravagance at the top. That's French Revolution stuff. And that's very clear since the early 70s, you just absolutely start destroying the middle class and the merchant class. And part of you're destroying the merchant class is this, in the late 60s and 70s, you destroyed mom and pop grocery stores, the corner groceries, the, you know, all those little manufacturing things because, you know, the big chains came in. You remember you went to the big supermarket stores and whatever, and you killed shops and whatever. Then, of course, now you fast forward to the Walmart and then Amazon. And the point being is you just keep killing the merchant class more and more and more here with big. And at some point, you look around again and your living standards aren't going well. You've got crime. You've got horrible education system, you know, just falling apart. And then you start losing hope. Not only for yourself, but for your kids, your grandchildren, whatever. And then you get more and more resentment. Then you get more and more afraid. And then that whole just, you're right. You start building this into the culture, and this is what you get. And I mean, I understand, you know, that's what people, you can see what people are trying to do politically. But there's a big difference between talk and actually getting something done. And again, that's the immigration, all this stuff all feeds into this stuff. You know, but, you know, when you had these big immigration waves in the past, people were upset because they didn't want their jobs to be lost, but we still had, you know, with the different waves, you know, the Irish in the 19th century, and then you had the Jewish waves, the pogroms in the before World War One, and you had the Italians after World War One. They were able to assimilate and get jobs, and, you know, we were in that uptick as a nation. Now it's totally different because people's living standards are going down, and they're going, oh, my God, we understand what this is about. You know, we understand why these people, you know, so the people at the top could even squeeze us more on our wages and, you know, whatever. So Yeah, if you're not doing well, then your antenna's up looking at all these things. If you're doing okay, you're providing for your family, and you're right, totally different mindset.
And just to borrow kind of from an analogy in art and culture, Aristotle wrote about it in his book, Poetics, you know, that sort of art imitates life. And right now we've got politicians reflecting life. You look at Ocasio-Cortez and Maxine Waters, and there is this, the rise of millennial socialism and an embrace of ideas which are very redistribution oriented. And again, it comes back to the sociological undercurrent, discontent. We really shouldn't be surprised. This is the political life as it's evolving, which reflects the disaffection, the dissatisfaction of the squeezed middle class. So, you know, as an investor, you wonder, what is the way that you position for changing sociological environment and a changing political backdrop, which is necessarily going to be highly extractive? If we're right and we're moving towards a period of redistribution and a wealth extraction, if you've got two nickels to rub together, what do you do with your two nickels?
Well, you got to be careful because everything is uncertain where you're going. I still maintain you have to have a balanced approach here. You have to be more vigilant. You know, in the past, you know, people, you invest for the long term, go, you know, forget about it. You know, stocks go up and down, gold goes up and down, bonds go up and down, but over the long term, yeah, everything goes blah, 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 blah. Well, the problem now is you got to be vigilant because as you're seeing the way the markets spasm and react because of what is going on here sociologically and politically and economically, financially here, you just have to be more vigilant. You've got to pay attention. You've got to be more careful than ever. And when assets get crazy, you always say, let your profits run. Absolutely. But you also have to be smart enough to understand that as your profits are running, you reduce your risk by taking some of those assets off the table and moving into cash or something else on a systematic basis. That's just the way you have to do it. So if you were fortunate enough and you bought stocks at the end of last year after Christmas Eve and you got these big gains in here, that's how you just cash everything in, but you should be taking profits off the table. You know, you just got to do it. Put your money into some short-term vehicles. And on the debt side, you have to stay short because we know the rates are unnaturally low. And I think you have to hedge that a bit with some kind of, you know, gold or silver or something, because things can happen so fast, we just don't know where this is going to go. To me, the ideal portfolio here is you want to be liquid, you want to be safe, but you also want to have a hedge from political problems. As you know, I've made this case, people keep overestimating the value of gold and inflation. The best hedge against inflation, persistent inflation, not rabid inflation, but persistent inflation is a company that can pass on their cost to consumers. That's what Buffett knows. And anybody can raise their pricing power and has a brand, you know, Disney, you name it. And that's what he's gone for. Dairy Queen, you know, these different things. That's his bet on people that have brands, consumers are going to keep consuming it, and they have pricing power. Where the gold comes in, and it's not just when inflation just really gets out of control and companies can't keep up. They really are actually getting hurt because their supplies, they can't pass the cost on as fast. The other thing is that people keep forgetting with the gold, the political aspect. The reason gold went berserk in late 78 through 79, you can look at the chart, everybody thinks this was gold was in a nice bull market, but it went berserk was because of what Jimmy Carter was doing. He just sat there on his hands. You know, the Shah was overthrown. Russians were in Afghanistan. The Ortega brothers were in Nicaragua. And he didn't care. And then the Japanese finally said, you know what, we're tired of buying U.S. bonds. We want our bonds denominated in yen. We don't trust you guys anymore. And that's the political. And if you notice, when gold went berserk at the end of this year, it was because the Democrats took over the House. And they made it clear, we're going to impeach Trump. We're going to do all these things. We're going to do all this yada, yada, yada. And that, to me, was a missing ingredient for the big gold, is when you have political problems, political turmoil. And I think one of the reasons the gold has settled down here is because over the last 2 weeks, you've seen the evidence come out that there is nothing here. There's no way they can impeach Trump. You know, last week, Pelosi came out and said, you know, there's nothing here. We can't impeach Trump. And then even Schiff, who for 2 years is, there's Russian collusion. There's a lot of smoke. There's the evidence. There's ample blah. He came out and goes, well, I agree with the speaker. Unless you have conclusive evidence, you can't do the impeachment. So I think that's one of the reasons gold has kind of tempered down here, is that they figured out here that there's nothing here. And in fact, you might be going the other way here very shortly, is that now this investigation is going to go into who perpetuated this fraud. on the United States of America. And you know, do we have sedition here? Do we have people trying? It's pretty clear. It's what seems where this is headed is where you had elements in the deep state were trying to frame a president and overturn a political election. And you even see now the Democrats throwing in the towel on a lot of that right now. So that's what I think to think to watch your globally is political turmoil with gold. That's the missing factor that most people do not understand about gold, is that when you see the political problems, you know, and that's the trade. You see political problems like you did in, you know, 2011 or in Europe or whatever, you get gold and the dollar go up. That was an indication, you know, you start seeing when the dollar and gold go up together, that's usually a political problem somewhere.
That's an interesting parallel. Is there a way to kind of, in a nutshell, describe this imbroglio between Clinton, Trump, Obama, the FBI, DOJ, Mueller?
It's there in mainstream media doesn't want to talk about it, but you had Hillary Clinton doing things she shouldn't have been doing. You had Obama doing things he shouldn't have been doing. They never thought Trump was going to win, and when he won, they had an enormous problem. And that's why you see guys like his ex-CIA directors and ex-NSA directors going on TV, taking TV gigs, and screaming that the presidents are criminal. It's unprecedented. And you ask it, why are they doing that? Because they're afraid of going to jail. That's what this is all about. I mean, you see it, it's there. And the top echelons of the FBI, the Justice Department, they did things they weren't supposed to do. And they never thought that this guy was going to win. And when he did, they were in a deep panic. And that's what's going on, and that's what's going to be unwound. And I think Trump's holding back on the declassification documents because he wants to keep it as close as possible to 2020 for the maximum political benefit. And I think as this year goes on, I think you're going to see more and more. And you can see it now with the leaks that have come out recently here about what was going on and how bad this stuff has been and how it not only exonerates Trump but the other people here. And the 2020 campaign is on. We see that. We see the Democratic people position themselves. We see, you know, the different leaks coming out. You know, the fact that they're producing a tape from the 80s about Bernie Sanders partying with communists and coming back here and saying, there's no Berlin, everything's great there and all that. Why wasn't that out before? Somebody's putting that out now because he's the front runner and trying to go after him. Same thing with somebody put out Joe Biden in the 70s was against desegregation and busing. Why wasn't that out years ago, decades ago? But the campaign's on now, and people are starting to position themselves and also trying to take shots at adversaries, you know, whatever else here. People kind of understand. You see John Solomon wrote up here that you're about to turn this for 2 years here of Trump the criminal and he's colluding. All of a sudden, that this thing's going to fall apart soon, and then you're going to go the other way. And, you know, there's not a better political weather vane than Lindsey Graham. You know, he was against Trump in the beginning. Now he's for him, and he came out yesterday and calling for a special prosecutor on the abuses of FISA abuse, Department of Justice, FBI. You saw the stories come out this week about the Obama Justice Department told the FBI you cannot investigate Hillary Clinton, which, you know, that kind of sounds like obstruction of justice to my untrained ear. And how high up does this go? You know, the Loretta Lynch, the Bill Clinton, all these things start becoming in focus, and, you know, we'll see where all this goes in here. But that's, I think, the thing going in front of us. There's so many things on the plate here going forward. And on the one hand, you say, why are stocks going up with all this on here? But on the other hand, that's why these central banks are pumping money like crazy, because they see all these other things in here. And I think that they have no recourse, because God help us if we get a recession and we get the debt deflation starts. That's the game. That's the game.
That's probably your deciding factor in a 2020 election.
The big picture is, how do we prevent the debt deflation? How do we stop this? Because like I said, in the past, the central banks did it so they could cleanse the system, refurbish the system, rejuvenate the system, and get the next wave of growth. Now they're just petrified that we can't allow any recession of any kind. It boggles your mind when you think about that.
Well, as you say, we've got Trump who's kind of borrowing from the playbook of Andrew Jackson and Reagan and Nixon and really anybody that he thinks will get him the votes. As we come into the 2020, you know, he's done a very effective job of stripping out the union and sort of working class vote from the Democrats, the big surprise in the mid-states from that. And you know, if he can capture the populist discontent coming into 2020, he's reelectable. If we get a recession, stock market sell-off, there's some panic in the air, and then all of a sudden you've got the Democrats on the war path with, you know, buybacks and insider selling and break up the Bezos deal with Amazon, Elizabeth Warren, you really change the tone pretty considerably. And you could have Democrats take it if there's recession and stocks blowing up. it would seem. And if they can hold it together through 2020, Trump's probably savvy enough to capture that populist discontent and win again, don't you think?
I think you're right, but I think Trump's made a mistake pinning it on the stock market, because people remember 1984.
Right.
Everything was going to hell in 1984. You had the first SNL crisis in Ohio and Maryland. Chase Bank almost went down. Continental Bank did go down. That was unfathomable. And there were people going out of their minds saying, oh, my God, you're going to have to put, what, $4, $5, $6 billion. That was, oh, we can't, this is ridiculous. You had people not running because they were afraid of depression, but the bond market was, you know, backing up. Stocks had started tumbling. And everybody said, that's it. I remember a prominent economist, because my wife worked at the firm, said, I sold my house, I'm living in an apartment because we're going into depression. You know, Reagan juiced all this debt up to get us out, and these tax cuts were going into depression. 84 was a very, very tough year. What happened in the election there in 84? Reagan won 49 states, biggest blowout in history. Mondale barely held on to his home state. Like, he won Minnesota by a few thousand. That's the point. The stock market isn't the economy. More importantly, the American people liked what they thought Reagan was doing. And the final thing is, they thought Mondale was a far leftist. So would you say, well, Trump's approval rating, this, there, the other, that means nothing until you see who he's paired up against. And right now, with the Democrats running, is having a race to see who can get furthest left and come up with the biggest socialist. That benefits Trump. That's what benefits him more than the economy or the stock market. And this isn't Trump. America, they usually say, oh, it's a referendum on a president. No, because Obama would have lost. Obama, in July of 2012, Axelrod went to Obama's chief political group, the guy who made him here in Chicago, went to him and said, you're going to lose. The economy was not good. You know, that's when you did your QE3 in that year, just, you know, you had the Europe stuff. And so what are we going to do? And said, well, let's go real hard, negative, on Romney, see what happens. They did, and Romney never responded. People go, why are you doing? What are you doing? Well, I'm going to wait. Well, you did wait, then you had the hurricane, and Romney lost the race he should have never lost. It wasn't Obama's vote total went down, but the Republicans didn't come out because they didn't like Romney. They didn't like his slick hair. They didn't like that he looked like he was effete in the debates. He let Candy Crowley from CNN slap him around without responding. And that's what you don't know. So this is, it's not just a referendum on the president, whatever. It's who's the other candidate that you're putting up here. And that's right now, the Democrats don't have a viable candidate yet. And if you find somebody who could appeal to the Midwest, the middle class, like you said, if you could find somebody that has an economic platform that would appeal to flyover America, they'll win. And that's the only reason Trump won. He put up a platform that appealed to flyover America. And that's what the race will be again this time around.
So in the interim, as we wrap up our conversation, you know, for the investor, it's a question of staying liquid, staying safe, staying hedged against political problems, watching the impacts of debt. If you're in the debt markets, stay on the short end of the curve. It's a challenging environment.
Oh, yes. Yeah. You know, it's not the ones where, you know, like you said, you have a balanced portfolio and you don't worry about it. You know, you look at your statements every quarter or whatever, and you can't do that anymore, unfortunately, because you can see what happened in the fourth quarter. You can see what happened in the first quarter here. The markets don't, that's not natural. These spasms are not natural. The problems are the central banks have financialized everything. And when you got into the financialization, then you put these big hedge funds, these big fast money guys with trillions of dollars that they can leverage into trillions more. And they're controlling the market. It is not an investment grade market anymore. It's a financialized market where people go in there to make profits. They're not in there to, you know, the whole idea, the whole rationale for having a stock market is to raise capital, you know, capital formation for your economy and for businesses. That's not the case anymore. Not when you allow high frequency trading, you let all this other nonsense, all these quants all of a sudden, they don't talk about the economy. They talk about how to siphon money out of the economy. And where's the money coming from? Well, it's coming from the Fed and central banks and the monetization. And that's what does not get into the real economy, because it's going into a selected number of people's hands. And what are they doing with it? Do they turn around and finance companies? No, they just keep doing more financialization. I mean, you know, at least in the 80s, you remember you talked about seed money. You talked about, you know, the guys that seeded Apple, seeded these companies. You know, there were these guys out in Silicon Valley that were tech savvy, and they gave money to these guys and created businesses. Are you hearing that now with these big hedge funds? What are they doing besides buying bigger mansions or, you know, whatever? Are they doing? Are they building hospitals? Like, at least when the robber barons build hospitals in Carnegie Hall or, you know, the Guggenheim Museum, what are they doing? They just keep, well, let's buy another apartment. Let's buy a bigger apartment in Manhattan. Let's buy bigger houses here, whatever. And that's the problem with the economy and the society. And the reason they're not doing it is they're afraid, too. They don't see any viable, but just like Buffett sitting on a record amount of cash. He doesn't see any viable operations or companies out there. You know, who's he seeding? With all this money, is he seeding entrepreneurs for the next technologies, the new whatever here? And that's the problem.
You know, in our past conversations, we've talked about how the free markets basically went extinct decades ago. And yeah, I almost feel like a heretic saying this, but don't you come closer to definancializing, moving away from the fast money guys, running the markets and moving back towards something that is more free market oriented in the context of, you know, an Elizabeth Warren challenging Bezos or, you know, regulation changing in causing a shift. And I feel like a heretic in suggesting it, but the Republicans have not proven to be particularly free market in their orientation. They've promoted the financialization. Democrats have too. And so now the race to the left, race to the far left in terms of politics, it's almost as if I don't know who else but the far, far left would promote an adequate legislative suite, which would be sort of a slapdown for the current malinvestment system that we have through the debt markets and through radical liquidity being created and the whole universe being financialized.
Well, the problem is there is no capital. You know, FDR effectively, you know, started the demise of capitalism, and it just kept accelerating over the years, and everything is becoming more and more central command economy. So you're at the point now where the Fed is in charge of the economy because the politicians, you know, have ceded control of the economy to the Fed, so they don't have to make tough decisions. They see the debt, but they can't make tough decisions about taxes and spending. So as long as the Fed keeps financing this game, we don't have to make tough decisions. You see that now with all these stupid continuing resolutions they have to put through to finance the economy, keep from a government shutdown. It's a stupid process, but this is what the central banks and the academics want to run the economy. Okay, go ahead and do it until we get the big blow up. And that's why they were so scared in 2008, because the, you know, let's face it, there should have been a reformation of the Fed, not just the banks. There should have been a reform of the Fed for allowing this bubble to go on like they did and they've done for the last couple decades. But the politicians were, they didn't want to touch it, just like in Europe. There's no reform. I mean, Draghi says that virtually every time he speaks. We need reform. We need reform. Yeah, 10 years later, how's that working out for you, Mario? Where's your reform? But at the same time, it's like saying, well, we can't spoil our children, but here's a $100 bill. Go out, buy some candy and some whatever else you want, some beer. You can't lecture the politicians about you need to do this, and at the same time, you're enabling them to not take on responsibility. And that's what the whole thing, nobody wants to make the tough decision now. Nobody. You know, you can't even talk about immigration here in the United States. You can't even come up with a policy or to reform. Everybody's been talking about it for, what, two decades now? And they won't make the tough decision.
Well, the House suggested a very tough decision, something that, you know, obviously might fix everything, just approve illegal immigrant voting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we know that. I mean, everybody understands that. It's just not even a pretense or game anymore. Same thing with, you know, with voter ID. Everybody understands what the game is. And it's clear, but you made a key point. Republicans don't want to fight. That's the biggest difference we're having Trump in. He's the first guy since Reagan that will fight. And the Republicans don't know how to fight. They know how to roll over. They know how to cower, and they're afraid. What are they afraid of? Well, they're afraid the media will say something bad. So what? They don't represent their constituency, and that's what's still going on in Washington here and why you don't have anything is they're still afraid. Trump blew up the Republican Party. He destroyed the Rockefeller wing, which was the Bush wing. And you see that if you look at the people yesterday who voted against Bush with the national emergency, with the exception of maybe Rand Paul, who's doing it on an ideological basis, these other people are all anti-Trump establishment people for the most part. And they're purging that party. Now, the Democrats are going through a similar thing now, where they purged the Clintons and they got Obama, but then they brought Hillary back in, and then she blew up to Trump, and so now the Democrats have the problem is that Trump came in and co-opted their economic issues, the globalization, the union, the whole routine here. They have no economic issues except we'll give everything for free to everybody. And that's where they're all running hard to the left. And then we're going to take wealth from all you people, which I find hilarious that they're talking to going after all these tech billionaires who are overwhelmingly leftists. But they just thought, yeah, we'll keep talking left. We'll support all these leftist candidates. And if you look at history, that's what happens all the time. When the powers that be get scared of the left, they support them, they give them money, and then they come and they get them, and they chop their heads off with the guillotine. And that's why I just find it hilarious now that Elizabeth Warren, all these people that took all this money from Silicon Valley is now talking about, well, we got to go after them because that's the only way they can stay in power. That's where the mass votes are now. So it's a fascinating and dangerous period right now. And as I said this a couple of years ago, you know, everybody's worried about Trump. I didn't worry about Trump. I didn't fear Trump. I know what he is. Obama was similar, is that people were fed up with the Bush and the East Coast Republicans, the banking establishment, the Chamber of Commerce Republicans, and they opted to have the new guy who had little or no political experience, had no gravitas. Then they didn't like what Obama did, so they went with this guy who had no political experience. He went from limited political experience to no political experience. But that's, if Trump fails, who comes next? I'm not so worried about the 2020. It's the 2024. Because if Trump fails with the two-term, you know, history shows you get two terms, and if you don't do a good job, you're out, which is George Bush II, Obama. The only one, Reagan did a great job, so he got George Bush in, which was the first time a sitting vice president from a two-term president had been elected since Martin Van Buren after Andrew Jackson, who the people who got the two terms, and they liked them. That just shows you how that kind of works. If you're a two-term president, you better, you do a good job, and the next guy gets a chance. And that party gets a chance from the next guy. You know, if you keep pushing hard to the left, and you get, you know, I don't see it for 2020 yet. I don't think the events can move fast enough to make a big difference a year and change from now. But it's going to be after that where I think you're going to have the real problems.
Well, we'll continue the conversation as we get closer to 2024. Try to parse where the risk is, where the opportunity is. Thanks, as always, for joining us on the commentary.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Bill King. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.